Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
In 1941, fundraiser Molly Moon organized her first Beaux-Arts Ball. It was an extravagant costume party inspired by Caribbean carnival and drag balls. It included black and white attendees and was sponsored by celebrities like Orson Welles and Paul Robeson. Molly was the queen of the party. She literally dressed like Marie Antoinette. She ruled that party and the parties that followed for the next 50 years. Ebony Magazine would name her the social ruler of New York. But these balls were so much more than just fun. They had a bigger purpose. The first two balls raised money for the Harlem Community Art Center, while later balls supported civil rights organizations like the National Urban League. The public saw Molly Moon as a socialite, but she was always working behind the scenes to advance racial justice. Today, she's considered one of the most influential women of the civil rights era. This is Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. This hour, we're learning about two women who advanced civil rights, but have often been overlooked in our history books. Later in the show, we'll listen back to a conversation about New Haven's Constance Baker Motley. She was the first Black woman to become a federal judge in the U.S. But first, Dr. Tanisha C. Ford is professor of history at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Her most recent book is Our Secret Society, Molly Moon and the Glamour, Money, and Power Behind the Civil Rights Movement. Professor, it's great to have you back on Disrupted.
Thanks so much for having me back.
You know, the last time we had you on, you were talking about your book, Dressed in Dreams, about your connections to fashion and culture and the ways it helps us chronicle through not just fashion, but really our experience and development. And this newest book is quite different from the previous things that you've done, but is still connected to telling these stories of connection. Share with our listeners how you became interested in and discovered Molly Moon.
I actually discovered Molly Moon back when I was a graduate student at Indiana University. I was at the Schomburg Center doing research, looking for someone else, looking for a fashion model, as you mentioned, someone who would be more in line with my earlier work. And finding that fashion model, I discovered the name Molly Moon because that fashion model had actually been a beauty contestant in Molly Moon's annual Miss Beaux-Arts Ball pageant. And I was really taken with the name Molly Moon because I didn't know many Black Mollies. I mean, this is before Issa Rae's Insecure, you know? So I was like, oh, Molly Moon, I'm going to start collecting anything I can about this woman. And before long, I had amassed a couple of hundred newspaper clippings of Molly Moon. And it was very clear to me in these clippings from the early 1960s that she was the grand dame of Harlem. But things began to change a bit once I realized that these weren't just parties that she was hosting. These were fundraisers for the civil rights movement.
That angle of how this woman, first of all, the name Molly Moon in and of itself is spectacular and wants you to be in the piece of who is she? What did she do? But aside from, as you say, these amazing balls and celebrations, she was really an architect of thinking about how do we finance the movement for freedom? And she was doing it at a time when there was a lot of consternation about that, where women, particularly Black women, were not thought of as the leaders or the front-facing leaders of that, but were so critical to doing that work. Talk to us about the title, Our Secret Society, because I think it speaks to the ways that these events were so critical and still not really highlighted and platformed as a way of financing freedom.
Exactly. That's exactly it. I realized that Once I started to realize that Molly Moon's events were fundraisers, I realized that as someone who considers herself a scholar of the long Black freedom movement, that I had not even thought about the money and the money it takes to launch and sustain a large scale movement for social justice. And I started to ask myself why. And a large part of that is because we don't want to follow the money. It might lead to these messy places, you know, and messy relationships and connections. And if we have put our civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and, you know, other folks on a pedestal, then what does it mean then to ask how they were connected to money and the flows of money through the movement? So this language of secret or a secret society really gets at the fact that money was moving behind the scenes and that there were women who were instrumental in helping to move that money. Now, Molly Moon established her National Urban League Guild in the early 1940s to be a fundraising wing and a, you know, public relations wing of the National Urban League, meaning that they were charged with educating the broader community on the Urban League and the good works that it was doing for Black migrant communities across the United States. By the time I encountered Molly Moon in the archive in the early 1960s, the National Urban League Guild had become a movement within the larger movement where you had chapters, guild chapters across the country, Black women who have amassed social and political power in their local communities and who work in conversation with their local churches, their sororities and fraternities, chapters of the Lynx, Jack and Jill, bridge clubs, labor unions and groups. So it was this constellation, or what I call a Black freedom financial grid, that connected these various organizations, Black women being crucial nodal points locally, who would help move and distribute that money across the country to get it to cities and organizations that needed it the most.
Tanisha, you and I share an organizational affiliation with Molly Moon. And as grownups, let's put it that way, people will often ask me, why are you still involved in a sorority? Or why does that kind of membership matter to you at this stage of your life? And I always remind people that it's not just what you see and imagine on TV or movies. It is a network. It is a leadership development space. Often when Black women were denied access, also in Black spaces like churches, to be leaders, through these organizations, they could move money, as you say, they could foster leadership, they could create opportunities, and they could set agendas on their own terms. So that secret part of it is powerful, but it also creates legacy and a connection that I think becomes cross-generational. How important were those other organizational affiliations to helping Molly Moon emerge as a leader in the fundraising philanthropic space?
Those other relationships and affiliations were essential. We have to think, you know, we can talk about even the challenges as Black women that we face as we move into leadership today, but really let's transport ourselves back to Jim Crow era America, when Black women had even fewer opportunities for growth and development and far fewer vehicles through which they could do this work. So you had women like Molly Moon who were using their skills. Molly Moon was trained as a pharmacist, but became a social worker for the New York Department of Welfare, where she worked for many decades. And she used those skills as a social worker and kept those skills within her community, in large part because the nonprofit world wasn't giving opportunities to Black women to use these skills outside of our communities, but because there was a deep commitment to racial equality within the Black community. So it was important for me to think about not only how they're building relationships across organizations, but how they are utilizing the skills from their day jobs and applying them to the movement. So to that end, it was really interesting for me to take what we believe we would know about how Black organizations worked, you know, across organizations and those relationships, to see that come to bear in the archive. For example, in Atlanta, I was able to trace the Divine Nine organizations working with leaders of the Elks and local churches and HBCUs to fundraise money to host voter education and registration drives in the city. And it's that kind of cross-organizational affiliation that creates this this network or coalition of political voices, even though they might come from different political leanings or have different political approaches to the movement. You need that kind of coalition building in order to sustain a movement for racial justice.
I want to share with our listeners a quote from Molly Moon that actually appears on the back cover of the jacket for the book. Molly Moon says, "At an early age, I became aware of my obligation to participate in organized efforts to level the onerous barriers which locked me and my people in a ghastly cultural, political, and economic ghetto. Neither I nor my family had sufficient income to make significant financial contributions to this cause. We did, however, have commitment, energy, and time to contribute." Talk to us about how the Beaux-Arts Ball became one vehicle for Molly Moon to channel that commitment and that energy that then allowed her to become even more integral in financing that effort.
You know, I just love that quote. When I found it, it was the gold mine of finds. Because it's rare that we have Black women articulating an economic vision in their own words. And that just gives you so much insight to who Molly Moon was, a woman who did not grow up in wealth, but had time to contribute. And these are the elements of philanthropy that were central to our understanding and definition of philanthropy in the 19th century. And it isn't until the early 20th century that that term becomes associated with the wealthiest 1% in the United States. So when she's even articulating this vision, she's communicating the fact that African Americans have our own giving traditions that are horizontal in nature, that are about mutual aid and community support. So the Beaux-Arts Ball grows out of that. In fact, that affair as a fundraiser predates Molly Moon's work with the National Urban League Guild that she establishes. She hosts the first Beaux-Arts Ball as part of an initiative to save the Harlem Community Art Center, which was founded by Augusta Savage and then later run by Gwendolyn Bennett. It was this major artistic hub for Black youth and even adults in Harlem in the late 1930s and early 40s. That affair was a costumed affair. And like Molly's own articulation of Black mutual aid and philanthropy, it was one that celebrated the grassroots. It had a socialist perspective on social change. It was a place where everyday Black folks who had an investment in the community art center could come and dance and perform and wear their costumes. And so in many ways, it drew from West Indian Carnival and also from the drag balls that were popular in Harlem in the 1920s and 30s. So it was this Global South queer inflected fundraiser that Molly Moon then goes on to translate into a vehicle for the National Urban League. And when she does so, she's very clear about the fact that the vision for the National Urban League Guild, as well as its approach to fundraising, grows out of that Black radical left organizing tradition that she was a part of in the 1930s. So the Urban League has to expand to fit her vision, as she also is learning how to fundraise alongside that wealthiest 1% who now sees it as their, you know, personal, I don't want to be too pessimistic, but in my mind, they see this as an opportunity to be on the right side of history. It makes them look good if they're connected to this movement and to Molly Moon and everything that she's doing for the Black community.
That was Tanisha C. Ford, author of Our Secret Society, Molly Moon and the Glamour, Money, and Power Behind the Civil Rights Movement. Coming up, Dr. Ford talks about how Black women push for Molly Moon to receive her well-due recognition. And later we'll hear from the niece of Constance Baker Motley, the first Black woman to argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. This is Disrupted. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Today, we're hearing about some of the most important and overlooked women in civil rights history. Tanisha C. Ford's new book is Our Secret Society. It focuses on Molly Moon, a Black woman who raised millions to fund the civil rights movement. As a fundraiser, Molly often faced this big question. How much does it matter from whom the money is raised? As Dr. Ford, how Molly Moon navigated that challenge.
There was definitely major conflict there. And there was even conflict for me as the historian who, again, as I mentioned, I have my own opinions and views about this. I do think it matters where the money comes from. I do think that there is this danger, there's a real and present danger of, as your colleague Megan Ming Francis calls, movement capture of these wealthy individuals coming in and steering the movement in a different direction. And so part of my challenge as the historian was analyzing the source material to understand the conversation as it was unfolding then and holding that intention with my own perspectives as to what's going on, you know, having the historian's view, the distance to look back on the decisions that were being made. Molly Moon, she was a person who was clearly a part of these debates within the Black community, and they were very fraught debates about this very issue. Where is this money coming from? Can we trust these people? Should we trust these people? With the more Black radical sect of the movement saying, no, we should not trust these people and the sources of this money. And then those so-called Big Six leaders like Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young and others saying, yes, we can and we have to, because in order to create the kind of sustained infrastructural changes we want to see, we need the big dollars and we need corporate America and philanthropic foundations to support this, because if we get their support, then we can force the White House to push civil rights legislation. Molly Moon is caught in the middle of this because, as I mentioned earlier, the National Urban League Guild is the PR wing of the National Urban League. They are the public-facing women who represent this organization. And so if you are one of their big women leaders, even though you might not be one of the men who are seen as calling the shots, so to speak, on that, you know, that big picture leadership level, you are the one who's charged with enacting their strategies and trying to then hold those things as you work with everyday Black people and hearing their complaints and their needs and their visions. And Molly Moon was very strategic in saying, okay, the Urban League has committed itself to taking money from the Rockefellers and the Fieldses and the Javitses and all of these moneyed people. Great, let's pick their pocket and then figure out how to redistribute this money in ways that could benefit Black communities. And it was a connecting point for me to my earlier work with fashion, when I realized that the fashion designer Dapper Dan had benefited from some of these very uses that Molly Moon had for this money. Dapper Dan, someone who had been in trouble with the law, who had been incarcerated, who had dropped out of school, he is able to learn the skills of a journalist and even travel to the African continent through funding from the Urban League that undoubtedly Molly Moon helped to raise.
As I'm listening to you talk about the legacy of Molly Moon within the movement, but also for subsequent movements and efforts and people, and I began the book thinking or wondering, like, is Molly Moon just naive to the realities of how gender is playing out in these spaces? And then I realized, no, she wasn't naive at all. She was incredibly aware, but also had a belief in herself that she could make a difference and that she could inspire others, even if she didn't always feel that she was being respected in that way. One of the things that comes through the book as well is the way, not just how men or how Black men responded to her leadership. There's also a key piece, Professor, about how white women responded to Molly Moon's emergence and how many felt that she threatened their standing, but also questioned, why is she the person who can move not just money, but really move rooms in these ways? Talk to us a little bit about that, like that complex interplay of race and gender for Molly Moon, but also for other Black women who were supporting freedom movements.
Molly Moon was very conscious of her identity as a Black woman. And in certain ways, she reflects the gender norms of her time, but in many ways, she disrupts them. Even in this power coupling that she's a part of with her husband, Henry Moon, who is a major leader in the NAACP, he's their publicity director. And of course, she's this big figure in the National Urban League. I mean, they are this social justice power couple, but she is the one who's more outspoken, more visible. She has so much charisma and charm. I mean, if she were born in a later generation, she most certainly could have been an elected political official if she wanted to. And so there were people who had problems with this. And this especially reaches a fever pitch when Whitney Young takes over as the head of the Urban League, because he has very, in my mind, misogynistic images about women and their role in the movement. And so Molly Moon and other women or other people who are identified as women at the time, like Pauli Murray, really struggle against his leadership. And Pauli is more outspoken in challenging the sexism within the National Urban League and other civil rights organizations. Ella Baker is also very critical of this kind of male leadership of these, you know, more traditional civil rights movement organizations. Molly Moon is in many ways castigated because of the fact that she's not only linked to this more outspoken gender performance, but also because of her parties that are seen as these, you know, pleasure filled endeavors. And so it becomes a reflection in some people's eyes of her sexuality. And so she sues a white woman who's a major leader in the New York Urban League Guild. She sues her for $1 million in 1965 figures. So we're talking about tons of money. She sues her. The suit is settled out of court. So we don't know exactly what happens, but this woman does issue something of a public apology to Molly Moon, claiming that her statements about Molly Moon and her sexual proclivities were taken out of context. But what I love about Molly Moon's journey and the role that Black women have played in her life, once she's marginalized within the National Urban League, she reactivates her membership in Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. She becomes an early leader of what will become the National Coalition of 100 Black Women. She becomes a board member. So she doubles down with Black women to really center Black women's issues as the movement moves into the 1970s. And it's Black women who are responsible for censoring her in the history of the National Urban League. They say, no longer will we sit and watch you all praise every male leader who comes through the National Urban League while not recognizing Molly Moon, oftentimes at her own Beaux-Arts ball, which she is still organizing well into her senior years. So it's Black women who reclaimed her. And as a Black women's historian, it was beautiful for me to not have to abstractly make that claim, but to see Black women actually showing up for Molly Moon in the archive and really forcing the Urban League to create a Molly Moon Volunteer Service Award, which is still awarded today annually. That was Black women's work. And I think it was in large part because they saw the way that Molly Moon showed up for them as the women's movement was really accelerating in the late 60s and early 70s.
I will admit to you, and I guess by extension now to our listeners, As I was reading this book, frankly, I was embarrassed that I did not know the name Molly Moon, given all that she built, given all that she endured, and the many ways that she was such an amazing woman who not only goes unnoticed in some ways, but erased in others. And it begs the question, now that we know this story, now that we know how she fought and how she was able to reinvigorate her commitment to community, be undaunted in that, and practice what is really the highest art of Black women's resilience. My question to you, Professor, is what do we owe to the legacy of women like Molly Moon so that their efforts are no longer erased or pushed to the margins?
I love the fact that I'm able to use my skills as a historian to tease these seemingly lost histories from the archive, you know, to excavate these histories, to center someone like Molly Moon. It is vital for me that people read this book, not just because it's a product of mine, but because it allows us to see ourselves in new ways through telling and reading Molly Moon's story, a woman who was an iconoclast in many ways, a woman who was a visionary, who created a blueprint for fundraising for the civil rights movement. I especially want Black women who toil in these organizations today, performing labor that is often unseen, to recognize that you are part of a genealogy of Black women, not only just because that is affirming in and of itself, but so that we can study her blueprint. I want us to have an alternative understanding to the rise of the Black nonprofit sector and the many battles that were fought by Black women to establish that in the era of Jim Crow, when we couldn't receive social services from mainstream organizations, not even the federal government at that time. So this is just a vital history. And lastly, because so much of this is a changing same. When I was writing this book in 2020, watching everything unfold in the aftermath of the police killing of George Floyd and the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic, and seeing this seeming generosity of the white elite who are giving money, guilt giving, you know, or at least guilt promising. A lot of them didn't even follow through with those promises to give to Black Lives Matter organizations. And it made me think, wow, we've been here before, if people only knew. And that sentiment was only amplified for me once I started interviewing Black women who work in the nonprofit and philanthropic foundation world today, to see the same types of demeaning treatment that they often receive, the way that our organizations don't receive the kind of funding that white-headed organizations receive, and so forth. So part of this is understanding our history in hopes that this will help us affect change in the 21st century.
Long before most women could have a checking account or a credit card in their name, there was Molly Moon, who was moving money for freedom, for community, and as you said, creating a blueprint. Dr. Tanisha C. Ford is professor of history at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Her most recent book is Our Secret Society: Molly Moon and the Glamour, Money, and Power Behind the Civil Rights Movement. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me, Professor Brown Dean.
Coming up, we'll hear about pioneering judge Constance Baker Motley. This is Disrupted. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown Dean. This hour, we're hearing about two women whose roles in advancing civil rights have often been overlooked. Constance Baker Motley was born in New Haven, and she helped craft the argument in the landmark case, Brown versus Board of Education. She was the first Black woman to argue before the U.S. Supreme Court and the first Black woman to become a federal judge in the U.S. In 2022, I spoke with Connie Royster. She's a retired attorney, former director of development at the Yale Divinity School, and the niece of the late Justice Constance Baker Motley. I also spoke with Tomiko Brown Nagin, dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University. She's also a professor of constitutional law and history and author of the book, Civil Rights Queen, Constance Baker Motley and the Struggle for Equality. I started by asking Connie about her aunt, Constance Baker Motley, and how the family came to New Haven.
My grandparents, Judge Motley's mother and father, came from the teeny island of Nevis in the British West Indies in the beginning of the 1900s. First my grandfather and then my grandmother. And they landed in New Haven, having been advised that this is where jobs could be found at Yale. My aunt was the ninth of 13 children, so it was a big family. And the family was also the staging ground for other families coming from Nevis to New Haven. So it was an open home, open house, and the sofa was all often filled. They were also very much church people. So it was a very strong family and strong family life with very strong British, let's call it, implications. That is to say, very strict.
After leaving New Haven, Constance Baker Motley earned her bachelor's degree at New York University. And in 1946, she graduated from Columbia Law School. Her mentors hoped that she might join a prestigious firm in New York City, but instead, she took a position with the NAACP's Legal Defense and Educational Fund. It's sometimes known as the Inc. I asked Connie to describe how her aunt came to work with the NAACP. She says that opportunity may have been kismet.
The transition and her opportunity to get a job with the Legal Defense Fund, thanks to a fellow classmate who was leaving a position at the Legal Defense Fund and introduced her to Thurgood Marshall, it was a transition that she was able to make and was, again, kind of a divine intervention, a fortuitous opportunity that I think we all need to be very grateful for. And I'll turn it back to Tamiko on that one.
Sure. I think it's important to emphasize the contrast between her experience with those law firms that she applied to and essentially had the door closed in her face, and the interaction with Thurgood Marshall, where he hired her on the spot when she came to interview for the internship position and regaled her with stories about Black women whom he had known, who had worked outside of the home, primarily teachers, and he could see her talent. And she grew into this tremendous lawyer while working at the Ing Fund for 20 years, and which is not to say that it was a perfect workplace. Indeed, it was not. There were blind spots around gender in that workplace, as would have been the case for, you know, in any workplace at that time. And yet she adored Thurgood Marshall and always talked about him as someone who took a chance on her at a time when other firms, other entities were not taking a chance on women. And I mean that not, these were talented women, not only Motley, Sandra Day O'Connor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, none of these amazing women, excellent lawyers, could get jobs at that time in other places. And so she always said that had it not been for Thurgood Marshall, no one ever would have heard of Constance Baker Motley. And I think that's an important point to make about her experience at the Ing Fund.
I think that context is critical because we have a tendency in looking back on history to make it very simple and simplistic, and to think about the understandings at the time, the challenges that people faced at the time, and understanding that attacking Jim Crow was literally a threat to people's lives and livelihood to take that on. And yet Constance Baker Motley did it. She went to the South to protest these things in a way that said, let's make the law work for the people, even if they are thought of being beyond the bounds of that protection and freedom. And Tamiko, you open in your book by sharing with the readers a story about the killing of Sam Terry in 1949 and the subsequent battle that Motley led to get justice for his family. Why do you think it was so important to tell that story in that context?
Well, I tell that story because it is sadly so relevant to today. in an age when we are involved in, it is said, a racial reckoning after the killing of so many Black people, Black men in particular, George Floyd, really bringing to the forefront for a lot of people who perhaps had not been really looking, that Black life is devalued in this country, and it's been devalued for a very long time. And I thought it important to open my book by setting the scene in a way that shows the continuity in the experience of race and racism in America. At the same time, I wanted to show the breadth of Judge Motley's experience as a lawyer. She was involved in, you know, these cases defending Black veterans and soldiers, housing cases, voting rights. She represented criminal defendants. And then all of these school cases at both the K through 12 and higher education level. She was just an amazingly talented lawyer who had such a tremendous impact on changing the legal architecture of this country.
Connie, one of the realities in the U.S. is that for women, particularly for Black women, it's not enough to just be qualified or to meet the basic standard. Black women often have to be overqualified, and it still does not guarantee the kinds of opportunities that some other people take for granted. And one of the pivots in your aunt's life that I want us to think about and how she was able to, as Tomiko said, work in so many spaces, is that after being passed over for a promotion at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, she pursued other opportunities. But I think it speaks to the continuing challenge. What was that experience like for her? And what was the pivot to say, I will now take my experience and my talent into the political space and raise these same issues that I've been passionate about for so long?
I think that speaks to who she was and what her upbringing was. You don't give up. You take what you've learned and you take the family values and you move forward. I think to pick up on what Tomiko was just talking about, the situation with the George Floyd killings and what's happened more recently that's come to public light, although we've known about it forever. I'm very glad that she's not around to be seeing some of this, because, you know, she lived through the Bull Connor and, you know, the sicking of dogs on people and spraying of hot water hydrants on protesters. And, you know, that she wasn't here to see George Floyd lynched by people charged with serving the public. And every day we seem to hear of some other police killing of unarmed Black men. And Tomiko just mentioned, you know, that we are in a very difficult period in time. And I think she would have been very saddened and even sick to her stomach, the way Tomiko's book describes how, you know, she took to her bed after Medgar Evers was killed. At the same time, she would say that we have no choice but to keep fighting. And that's part of her makeup, right? It's part of who she was. She may have gone to bed for a bit, but she then got up and continued in her particular fight. Her way of fighting was to pivot to the political arena and do it extraordinarily well. For someone who had no political experience and really not a real political bone in her body in terms of, you know, prior experience in that arena. And then she took that on. And I think that even in today's way of looking at things, she would say, that's what we have to do. And that's what we as a people do. We keep going.
This episode originally aired 2 years ago, shortly after Associate Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court. She talked about Constance Baker Motley after President Joe Biden announced her nomination.
As it happens, I share a birthday with the first Black woman ever to be appointed as a federal judge, the Honorable Constance Baker Motley. We were born exactly 49 years to the day apart. Today, I proudly stand on Judge Motley's shoulders, sharing not only her birthday, but also her steadfast and courageous commitment to equal justice under law.
I asked Tomiko Brown Nagin what we need to remember and honor about Judge Motley.
You know, I was so happy to hear Judge Jackson, now Associate Justice Jackson, call out Constance Baker Motley's name. I thought it was a mark of character, that she did that, that she remembered the elders, that she remembered who paved the way. I had great resonance with that moment, not only because I just wrote a book about this amazing figure, but it spoke to me as a woman of color, as a Black woman, to just carry that legacy forward. And what is the legacy? Well, it's a legacy of using her intellect to undo Jim Crow, to undo racial oppression in this country under law. And we need to not lose sight of what a tremendous accomplishment that was. And I say this in part because it is true that there is terrible continuity in America's racial history. But certainly for those of us who grew up in the Deep South, we also know there has been tremendous change in this country. And we need to recognize that it's Constance Baker Motley, in addition to Thurgood Marshall and all of the men whose names many of us have known for a very long time, who helped to bring about that change. And through personal fortitude, resilience, sacrifice in her family life, that is her legacy, and it's one that we can be proud of, we should lift up, and that we should carry forward. It's our turn now. It's our turn now. And those are some of the things that I think about when I am asked to reflect on what Motley's legacy is.
Connie, I want to turn to you because more than just being this groundbreaking pioneer, Constance Baker Motley was your aunt. And I think I shared this with you a couple years ago, randomly when we crossed paths in a grocery store parking lot, of what it meant for my young daughter at the time to do her project on Constance Baker Motley. And to say, even in her hometown of New Haven, there are people who aren't aware of this outsized impact that she had on our country and the rights we have today that we often take for granted or overlook the progress, as Tomiko mentioned. What do you think we should be doing collectively to honor your aunt's legacy, but to ensure that there's not another generation of young people who not only don't know her name, but don't recognize the impact on this country?
It is really on us to make sure that the legacy is preserved, passed down, passed on. It truly astonishes me that New Haven, Connecticut, in large measure, Yale University, which gave her an honorary degree in 1987, that these places have not embraced their daughter. And Chester, Connecticut, where she had a summer home for 40 years, has honored her and has, you know, recognize that, you know, her presence there means something and meant something to United States history. And so there's the Chester Land Trust has established the Little Rock Nine Trail, and her home there is on the Connecticut Freedom Trail. And things have happened there, but nothing's really happened in New Haven of any significance that we can take our children like your daughter and say, this is Constance Baker Motley. This was her home and she should be in the history books just like all the men who are there. And I think that what we've experienced over the last few years with first, Kamala Harris mentioning her when she accepted the nomination for the vice presidency. And I'm sitting there listening, and she says, you know, and I owe my career to Constance Baker Motley, and I'm jumping off my seat because nobody has said that in public. Literally, nobody's mentioned her name, whereas so much of where we are today, as Tamika has just, you know, listed, we owe to her. This country really does owe so much to her. And so on the national stage, that we need to be thinking, what do we need to do to make sure that her legacy is known and that she is no longer a hidden figure? So the sky's open, right? We need to think big about how to honor this amazing human being. I am so grateful to Tamika for this book. This is groundbreaking. And while they say that timing is everything, timing is everything. And, you know, the nomination, and this book, and an effort right now to get a Congressional Gold Medal. I think these are really important things. And so naming opportunities. Come on, let's just do it. Yale, as you mentioned a while back to me, Yale was a missed opportunity not naming a college in her name.
That's right. And I did submit her name when Yale was considering renaming Calhoun College, but there'll be other opportunities for Yale to lift up Motley, and as well as for New Haven, for Connecticut, for the nation. You know, there ought to be schools named for her. There ought to be a wonderful statue of her. It should, you know, she stood nearly 6 feet tall, and I would love to see an imposing statue of Motley, so that people publicly can engage with her legacy. There's a lot that can be done, and I am so proud to send this book out into the world at such a timely moment. And I am hoping that with all of the references to Motley and with the book, that our desire that her name be etched in every possible public space will be realized.
Constance Baker Motley's name isn't yet etched in public spaces, but she's well on her way. Earlier this year, the U.S. Postal Service unveiled its Constance Baker Motley stamp. She's the 47th honoree in the Black Heritage Stamp Series. Her niece Connie Royster invited me and my family to attend the ceremony dedicating that stamp in New York. Artist Charlie Palmer created the art for the stamp and also attended the event.
It was truly an honor to be asked by the U.S. Postal Service to do a stamp of Judge Constance Baker Motley. She was a hero of mine, as she was to many.
Sherilyn Ifill is former president of the Legal Defense Fund. She had the following to say.
The world in which she became a top litigator at LDF, and when she transformed universities in the South and upended rules of white supremacy, was not one made for women, and certainly not for Black women.
But some of the most memorable words came from Judge Motley's niece, Connie Royster.
I'd like to think that the creation of this stamp by the United States Postal Service, Tamika Brown Nagin's recent biography, Civil Rights Queen, and Charlie Palmer's beautiful art will literally stamp into history Judge Motley's place as the national treasure forever. Thank you.
as a mom, as a student of history, and someone constantly in awe of Judge Motley and the tremendous path that she blazed for others, it was a wonderful occasion to not only celebrate her legacy, but to share that occasion with our own daughter. Disrupted is produced by Kevin Chang Barnum, Wayne Edwards, Meg Dalton, and Katie Tularski. Our interns are Scout Raimondo and Sajina Shrestha. Special thanks to my daughter, Haley Dean. You can listen to all the previous episodes of Disrupted by finding us wherever you get your podcast. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Thanks for listening.